My name is Ray O'Keefe, and I'm an alcoholic. It's a great pleasure to be at this Mon Eagle Retreat Conference Roundup. Al-Anon Rook Playing Marathon. It isn't often that you let a Yankee land in the Athens of the South, touch down in the heart of Dixie, and end up at the top of Tennessee. Stephanie and I have enjoyed the whole thing. I spent a few moments this afternoon trying to strangle a rooster. And someone told me there were chickens sitting in trees. Well, in New York, we know about that. Chickens don't fly in trees, I told him. So he took me over, and I have an announcement for those of you who are not familiar with the habits of chickens. They roost in magnolia trees. And to the guru and his wife, Martha, I have a special vote of thanks from the O'Keefes because they've made it possible for us to be here. I think I better tell you about my drinking. It's a thrill a minute. I don't want you to miss anything. Later I'll get to the humility part of it. I grew up in a section of New York City that was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. To show you how bad this neighborhood was, a guy like Andy Harper would be class in that neighborhood. I told him I'd get even for those overalls. Well, there are people drink in that neighborhood. Every once in a while, now I know your mind will boggle when you hear this, but every once in a while you would see someone actually drunk in my neighborhood. And if you looked at my house, my mother's apartment where we lived, you'd see somebody drunk there. My mother. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. She enjoyed wine and light spirits, and she would dispatch me down to get a few gallons of each when the relief checks came in. Everybody in the neighborhood knew about my brother Billy. Billy was a falling down drunk, and Billy was trouble. Billy O'Keefe was trouble. He would empty out saloons when he came in. So when I walked into the local joint and ordered up whatever it was that day, no one paid any attention. Just another O'Keefe falling by, doing what seems to come naturally to the O'Keefes. And I don't know what they gave me that day. I suppose it was beer. I really don't remember. But I know I liked it. I liked everything about it. There was absolutely nothing about alcohol that I didn't like. I liked the way it looked. I liked the way it tasted. I liked the way it smelled. I liked the noise, the smoke. The Irish music, the fist fights. If there's a way to freeze it, I'd eat it. Now, I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking, and I had all of the difficulties you might imagine a young man would have going through that system and drinking. And I was invited out of high school a record number of occasions. But I had a kindly Irish pastor, and he knew these things. He understood this problem. He knew the family. And every time they threw me out, he got me back in. Well, when I was finished with high school, or more accurately put, when they were finished with me, because of a mistake on the part of an admissions officer in a college someplace, I got an opportunity to go away to school. I left the neighborhood. I went to New England. When I left the neighborhood, my drinking changed. In the neighborhood, we drank beer, and we drank shots and beers. We call those bats and balls. When I got to college, they weren't drinking that way. There were no bars in that state. These people sat around in restaurants, sat at tables. They drank beer out of bottles, and they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words of a couple of songs. I was very collegiate. World War II was closing, and it seemed safe. So So one afternoon, on an impulse, I joined the Navy. And I ended up on a minesweeper in the city of San Francisco. And I hate to make this type of an admission in an Episcopal house, but I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier, and a new man slept on top. Now, don't get ahead of me, lady. This is difficult enough. I came back from my first liberty in the city of San Francisco, and I drank an awful lot of beer, and I came back and got in my bunk. And I had one of these rare nephritis attacks. And I met the guy that slept below me that night. He hadn't figured he'd be wet sometime in his naval career. The only thing that happened to me was I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. I was like immediate seniority. Well, one day this thing was floating around in the South Pacific, trying to stay out of harm's way. We were delivering the mail is what we were doing, bringing the mail to our fighting men. And the executive officer of the ship sent for me, and he told me something I was to hear many times in my life. And it never helped me with alcohol. I think it hurt me. He said, "You are a very, very smart kid, O'Keefe." And I agreed with him right away. I thought he was beginning to show good judgment. And he told me if I could go through a set of examinations, they would send me to the United States Naval Academy. And I ended up in a rather fancy prep school in Maryland. And I was there for about 3 months when the executive officer of the school sent for me. He apparently did not have as much experience as the other gentleman, because he told me they were tired of me being drunk, going over the fence, over the hill, through the hedge, out the window. And he suggested to me that I resign my appointment to the Naval Academy. And he put a suggestion in the form of a direct order. Being a well-trained naval type, I packed a bag and I thought they would send me about as far away as they could. But with characteristic military efficiency, I was placed on board the yacht of the President of the United States. But I was still a Navy. We got paid and I got drunk. And then I waited to get paid again. And then I got paid, and then I got drunk. I would like to report to you on my intimacy with the President and my participation in affairs of state. I have no such report to make. I can help you get a drink at any time, day or night, in Washington, D.C., if that problem ever arises in your life. Well, when my enlistment was over, I came back to the neighborhood. Everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy had gone west because he threw a guy off a roof. He was a New York City policeman and an early case of police brutality. Billy bounced a guy, a citizen of Puerto Rican ancestry, off a fifth-story roof, and the gentleman lived to discuss the matter with the sergeants. So Billy was west, and is still west. Billy is a room clerk in a hotel in Minneapolis, Minnesota, I'm told. And his message to my sister is that he's in a less than classy hotel in Minneapolis where he rules the front desk. He says he is firm but just. The 5220 Club was available for heroes, and I qualified for a few checks. I was back in the neighborhood joint. I was developing into a better-than-average shuffleboard player. I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions, and it occurred to me one Sunday afternoon, you know, you get those clear thoughts. One Sunday afternoon, I remembered that I had been to college. So I went back home, and I packed a bag, and I went back up to New England. And I got off a bus in the middle of a blizzard, and I walked into a restaurant, and there they were, wearing white shoes, singing songs. So I got a bottle of beer and a roommate, and in that order. And I settled down, finished college. And my college career was undistinguished. I stayed drunk most of the time. I went to classes sometimes, a lot of times. One day I was walking around the campus in my usual condition, and I saw a list on the bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate, pick up a degree. And my name was on the list. I thought I had another year to go. Good news from the college administration. So I called up the widow and I told her about this, and she came north for this great event. About 10 years later, Stephanie and I were at the college in another capacity, and they were still talking about my mother. Isn't often in the state of Vermont they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. I picked up a degree in the morning in a very elaborate ceremony, and I put the widow on a train, and then my roommate and I went back up to a town called Essex Junction, Vermont, to dig a big hole for George Anderson. George had wanted to put in a cesspool, and he owned the saloon, and Bob and I couldn't pay our bar bill, so we dug this hole in the afternoon. Shows you that a college degree is a helpful thing to have. Well, I worked that summer someplace, and I came home to the neighborhood. And my family is Irish, and the Irish operate by council of war. And the members of the council at that time were my uncles. And they got to be members of the council because they worked. And if you worked, you voted. It was a simple arrangement. And the vote of the council was unanimous that I go on the city police department, because that's what my father had done, and that's what my mother had done, and that's what my brother had done, and that's what I was supposed to do. And they told me, you should go on the cops. You will go on the cops. And I told them I had other plans. I was going to law school. I was going to be a lawyer. I was going to do what I wanted to do. I always did what I wanted to do. It's part of being an alcoholic. And I went to law school. And my drinking changed. I hate to be disloyal to my profession, but I want to tell you, when I got to law school, I was in the company of the biggest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. These people were deadly. Everybody had a suit with a vest, and they all wore eyeglasses. So you know what I did? I got a suit with a vest. I got a pair of glasses I don't think I needed. And I looked around for a companion, a playmate. My mother used to always tell me, play with nice boys your own age. So I looked for a nice boy my own age. I had one in college, but I looked for one to play with in law school, but I couldn't find anybody. Nobody was drinking. They were all studying. They were all grinding away. So I became the biggest grind they ever had in that place. And I didn't drink at all my first year. And very rarely did I drink in my second or third years. I studied. Except in the summers when I worked in hotels. And when you work in hotels, you drink for nothing. Which is part of being a policeman's son anyhow. Part of the heritage of the New York City Police. We have a saying up there, crime doesn't pay and neither does the New York City Police Department. When I finished law school, I was taken in to a large, white, Protestant, Anglo-Saxon, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. My superiors there were very wise men, I suppose, and they decided that I ought to be trained as a trial lawyer. And so very early on in my career, I was sent up to the courthouse to learn my trade in the city of New York. And I wasn't in the courthouse very long when I discovered that the wise guys did not do business in the courthouse. They were all operating out of a bar across the street from the courthouse. So I moved my office into the bar. I established credit and a priority on the telephone, and I began to learn to drink in a civilized fashion. There weren't too many members of the profession knocking down shots and beers where people could see them. I learned to drink scotch in a tall glass with ice. and fill it up with water and you sip on that. That's highly civilized. I discovered the very dry martini. Now that's another story. What the martini did to me is hard to describe, but nevertheless, to this day, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the dry martini is surely one of the greatest cases of unrequited love the world has ever seen. After a period of this training in the bar and in the courthouse, it became time in my natural development that I be married. And I had located a young lady, or as I found out this morning, she had located me. And now you know Stephanie, and you know that she is from a totally different background than my own. Stephanie was raised on a hill somewhere, in a house with devoted parents. And I met her when I was a bellhop and she was a guest in a hotel. I was a bellhop and she was a guest. And that pretty well characterizes the relationship right now. Well, we settled down and as Stephanie told you, she began to deliver children, a monotonous type of regularity. She had a timetable that is understandable only to the devout Roman Catholic. And she has a great knowledge of theology, Stephanie. She's very long on theology. Her medical knowledge is a little scanty, but theological problems she handles well. And after about the second or third of these children, I don't remember, I'm trying to forget. One day I got a phone call from the dean of the law school I had attended, and the dean asked me to come by and see him. So I fell by the institution and saw the dean, and he invited me to become a member of the faculty and to become Professor O'Keefe. And I responded with great alacrity, and there I was, Professor O'Keefe. That job made me a little nervous the first couple of years, and I tried to slow down the drinking. I don't think I ever did, but I tried. I knew I couldn't do this and drink. So I tried to keep it under control. I might have turned down one or two drinks in a three-year period, which by me is turning it under control. And Stephanie, I continued to teach, and Stephanie continued to have children. And we took some of her dough and bought a large, semi-authentic colonial home in a village called Larchmont, New York, a village which abounds in semi-authentic colonial homes. And we had it up to five children. And in the meantime, I had accumulated some jobs from the governor of our state, had put me on a few committees because of my affiliation with school. I had entered in a rather mild way politics. I had sort of attached myself to the periphery of a young senator from Massachusetts who seemed to be going places. I had an automobile and a membership in a second-rate club, and I had a house on a hill. And had you asked me in those days how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. In fact, whether you ask me or not, I would have been very happy to tell you just how well I was doing. It was one of my favorite themes. The truth of the matter is that at that time, at age 34, I was a terrific daily drunk. And my day would have killed a lesser man. I used to come to in the morning in that wet bed, because the problem with the kidneys had continued unabated all those years. And I used to go in the bathroom and do my morning calisthenics. And my calisthenics were performed with my head in a bowl. And I had all the water running, the water in the tub and the water in the shower and the water in the sink, because I didn't want Mrs. O'Keefe and all those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. I would come downstairs wearing my sincere blue suit with a vest and carrying over my shoulder like Santa Claus a sack of wet laundry. Because Ms. O'Keefe told me that she had diaper service for the children. And she did not think a lady of her stature and convent breeding should do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. And if you can imagine a man of my position, a man of my stature in the community, starting off each morning with a load of wash. But once I got my wash out of the way, I used to go into the refrigerator where I kept a bottle of vodka. My children used to call that Daddy's juice. And I'd take a few bangs on Daddy's juice, and then the question was I going to throw up in front of all these people? I knew if I lit up a cigarette, the whole thing was over. I would stagger out of that house, and I would head toward the railroad station. I was a commuter. And I don't know if the news has ever come down this far, but we have a railroad up there called the New Haven. And the New Haven Railroad has been known to strike terror into the heart of the soberest of men. But for a drunk in the morning, it is a very, very hazardous experience. This thing is dirty and unreliable and late. Happily, it goes to Grand Central. And if you know anything about Grand Central, you know that it is only incidentally a railroad station. It is primarily a collection of saloons. And if the train got to Grand Central, then help is immediately at hand. But many mornings I couldn't make it all the way into Grand Central. After all, this is a 35-minute ride. And so, fortunately, the city planners of New York have placed a white rose bar underneath the station at 125th Street, which is in the middle of Harlem. But many mornings would find the old professor at about 8:30 in the White Rose in the middle of Harlem, dispensing legal aid. And I was one of the few barroom lawyers in New York with an actual license to practice. Sooner or later, I would have to get to the school, and I'd get over to this imposing institution. And as soon as I got there, my first thought was how to get out of there. And I would invent something or other, and I would get out. And I would go to my first parish, where I really belonged, the barroom down by the courthouse. And by this time, the other lawyers were treating me like a mascot. And I'd walk in, they'd say, here he is, and we'd start. And some dough would go up on the bar, and somebody would do this, and I would do that. And we'd tell each other lies, and sometimes even money would change hands, and someone would buy lunch, and there'd be more of this. And it was great. It was killing me, but it was great. Somehow or other, I would have to go up and struggle at the school for an hour or two. A day, not every day. When I was finished there, I would go over to Grand Central. Because I may be a boy from New York City, but I understand the theory of commuting. I'm familiar with that theory. And commuters are entitled to drink before they get on the train to go home. So I'd have 10 or 12, and I'd get on the train, and I would go home for cocktails with Mrs. O'Keefe in my large, unpaid-for home in Larchmont, New York. And I would come home, and I would take Daddy's juice out of the refrigerator, if there was any left, and pour some into an old jelly glass and ask if anybody wanted a martini. Gracious living in the suburbs of New York City. And I would have a few powders, and then there would be a toss-up. Was I going to eat or not eat? Some evenings I would spend in civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car, being taken home by the police, running for local office, which is a story of itself. I ran for chief executive of my town. And a little before the election, I'd only lived there a year and a half when I announced that I was running. And I got the nomination, I ran. That's nothing, I didn't fool around. I'm a very strong individual. And I got off the train drunk one night on my way to a debate at the junior high school, sponsored by the League of Women Voters. And I was a little drunk. You know, I was walking. You could say that much for me. And I jumped into the cab, and I said to the cab driver, where's the high school? And he said, are you the guy that's running? I said, of course. He says, you don't know where the high school is? And I didn't. I didn't know where the idea was. I was happy to hear they had a high school because I had a very firm plank in my platform about education. I was for education. I'm still for education in a limited way. That was civic endeavor. Civic endeavor was also falling off the raft at the yacht club and insulting neighbors and alienating Stephanie's friends who number by the thousands in Larchmont, New York. And this was not, all of this activity that I described to you was not once in a while. This is every day. Weekends I save for binges. If the wind was right and other conditions permitted, I could get drunk three times on Saturday and twice on Sunday. Now, as everybody who's ever been married knows, that while all this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. Now, I paid no attention to this. Why should I? She's a woman. I don't listen to women. Furthermore, she's not a lawyer. What does she know about anything? And I would tell her that. Go away. Well, my activity drove her to a point where she could neither sleep nor could she eat. And so she betook herself to a doctor. Her physician, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. He could find nothing the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk. And this explained her condition to him, and he told her that she had an alcoholic on her hands who needed medical assistance. And so she came home with this message. And this house we lived in, a very comfortable house, we don't live there anymore. We childrened ourselves out of that house. There is a less polite word for that, but I'll leave it that way. Ms. O'Keefe came home to this house. Now, in this house we had, this colonial home, there was a room in this house that I truly enjoyed. It was a den, is what you would call this room. This room was beautiful, and it had paneling, and it had a big chair and a television set. And I'd sit there with one eye watching that TV, watching it merge. And on the walls of this room, I had erected a shrine. Now, the shrine I had erected was not to any saint that might be familiar to you. Now, this shrine was to me. And on the wall, I had pictures of O'Keefe with the great and the near great. I had diplomas and proclamations and plaques, all of which attested that I was a terrific fella. And I would sit in this room with a drink, watching TV. And when the commercial would come on, I'd look up at the wall and I'd say, you're fantastic, O'Keefe, and I would have another drink. Well, Mrs. O'Keefe came to pay a visit to the shrine this evening. And the message she brought me was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the professor, as an alcoholic. I was outraged. I rose to defend myself, as I had to. Point one of my brief that evening was a blanket indictment of the medical profession, and we know that they deserve it. And I argued that no doctor would ever diagnose a patient without having seen him, which may or may not be true, but it makes a good argument. Point two of my brief, I asked Stephanie a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. You want equal time, Bill? Well, at this point, this conversation was going downhill at a terrible rate. And then it happened. I don't know how this happened. In the middle of all of this, I was going. I was really terrific. In the middle of the whole thing, I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe, the first time I had ever admitted this to anyone, I admitted that there was at least the remote possibility that I drank too much. That was a very, very serious tactical error. Ms. O'Keefe does not fool around. She's a lady with resources. 3 days later, I was a prisoner in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was only there a matter of hours when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. I pointed this out to a guy who was going by in a white coat, and he assured me that it was deliberate. And I was very angry, and I was very resentful. I was very scared, is what I was. And I was mad and resentful and full of self-pity because it happened to be either very close to the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I thought that a man who had achieved all the things I had achieved in 35 years certainly deserved to spend his 35th birthday in a place other than where I was. And I told a man in a white coat that it was my 35th birthday. And I said, you know, 35 is the age upon which I have just become eligible to become President of the United States. And he said, you're here for a long time, aren't you? Well, I was mad. I was really mad. But as every alcoholic in this room knows, I was also sick. And they were separating me from alcohol, and I was sick. And I did all of the warm and wonderful things that alcoholics do when they're coming off booze. And I shook, and I sweat, and I did everything else you can think of for the next 4 or 5 days. And then I began to, I think the medical parlance is, sit up and take nourishment. And I was then visited by the staff of this hospital. And the first one in to see me was the head of the hospital, and I would have expected no one less. And he fixed his cool, professional glance upon me, this distinguished healer. And he asked me a question. It's a question that so many people ask alcoholics. It's such a ridiculous thing to tell anyone. It's such a brilliant line of inquiry. He gave me that wonderful medical look, and he said, tell me, Professor, why do you drink so much? So I told him. I told him about my wealthy parents. I told him Mommy and Daddy had a lot of money, and Mumsy and Daddy used to travel a lot, and I was left to be raised in the care of servants. And I had become insecure, and I had turned toward alcohol. And he said, he was very sympathetic, this man. He nodded, and he said, and that's a medical, oh boy, that's terrific. And he left, and a little while later, one of his associates came in, and he asked me the same question. So I told him. I told him about my impoverished youth. I told him about the beatings I had received at the hands of my drunken mother. I even told him about the time my sister Marie stole my rubber duck when I was 3 years old. And he told me that help was at hand. He said, you have come to the right place. He said, this will take a long, long time, and it's very expensive, but we can help you. And I said, thank you, doctor. And he left, and the last one in to see me was a gentleman of dubious medical qualifications, but a pronounced Middle European accent, who was very much taken with two things, my professorial status and the fact that I was wearing tennis sneakers in January. He thought there was something significant in the sneakers. He thought they were relevant. And so we had a little discussion about the sneakers. And after he got, he had exhausted the topic of the sneakers, he asked me the question. So I told him. I gave him a sexual aberration out of craft ebbing that drove him right across the room. He thought he had been given one of the last great degenerates of our time. And, well, I wasn't as smart as I wanted them to think, or perhaps I'm not as smart as I'd like you all to think, because, you know, they had a staff meeting in the afternoon, and they talked about the fat guy in room 102, and they came to the conclusion that they had a fraud on their hands. So they sent for Mrs. O'Keefe, and poor Stephanie had to come up through the snow and the ice. And I was told I had a visitor. It's very unusual for you to have a visitor so early in your stay, Professor. And I said, I was issued into a large room, and there was Stephanie, hysterical. And she told me that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. And I said, I'm ready. Let's go. Let's get out of here. But she said, no, and she prevailed upon me to stay. And she arranged for me to do some therapy. They had taken me once to occupational therapy and had forbidden me to go back again because I had demanded a chemistry set. And so I wasn't allowed to go, but she figured out some other therapy for me. And they brought me back to my room. Now, this was not some ordinary drying out joint. This was a real fancy rattle box. I mean, we were going for every dime my father-in-law could afford. Money was no object. And I had started a Monopoly game with three of the patients in this place who were not alcoholics but were in this mental institution. And I had this Monopoly game going. And one of these gentlemen was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. Now, if you know anything about the game of Monopoly, and you got some nut thinks he's you're his real estate broker, you get the boardwalk for about $1.80, you know. So, I was venting my ego via the Monopoly game, and I was cornering deals and stuff, and I was having a pretty good time, and I figured I had 3-4 more weeks until Stephanie's father's money ran out to practice up on this Monopoly game. And I was into about the second day of the Monopoly marathon when the guy in the white coat came around and he said, "You have a visitor, Professor." And I said, "Oh, you know." And into my room I went, and I expected no one, and I didn't think I'd ever see Stephanie again. And into my room came this big, tall, imposing-looking guy. And he told me that he was a member of the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that he had been asked to come over to speak to me by the hospital about the problem of alcohol. And I looked at him, and I said, "Alcoholics Anonymous, are you serious?" And I started with him. And he told me to shut up. Well, I figured he had not been properly instructed. I figured he hadn't been briefed. No one had told him who it was he was speaking to. So I continued to talk, and I was on my way into one of my things, and he told me to shut up and to sit down. Well, Jerry, I didn't mean to touch that microphone. I'll never touch it again, Jerry. He told me to sit down and to shut up, and he was tall. And he was imposing, and he was a long, long member of AA, and you know how they are. And I sat down, and for the first time in 35 years, I let someone lay it on me instead of me bumping on them. And he began to explain to me, as we are instructed to do in our book, what had happened to him. As I have given you a little idea of what happened to me. How he had found AA, how life had been for him since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to meetings. And I said, "You mean outside to meetings?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "I'll go with you any place outside." Besides that, he had given me matches. Now, no one else had let me have any matches. And I thought that showed a certain degree of confidence in me. And that's how it began with me. This man drove me all over Southern Connecticut. And I went to a lot of meetings and a lot of rooms, and there was a lot of people and a lot of smoke and a lot of coffee. And some of them would give me literature, and some would give me cigarettes and matches. And even sometimes they'd let me take a half a buck out of the collection because I wasn't allowed to have any money where I was. And they made arrangements for me to come back to home and go locally. And I don't remember a great deal of those early meetings that I went to in Connecticut. I was too new, too frightened, too nervous. And of course, the hospital was handing out those little pills that they give people who suffer from alcoholism, and that didn't help me, and that doesn't help alcoholics. Well, I came home and I went locally, and again, I don't remember. I left the hospital with a big bottle of those pills, and I was eating those, and they took me locally, and I have only a vague recollection of that. But I know me pretty well, and I figured I would come here to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me president. What the hell? I was president of everything else I ever joined. I would serve a term. You would give me a plaque. I would put it on the wall of the shrine. Onward and upward. So it should come as no surprise to you, but I tell you, it was a terrible shock to me to find out about 10 months later that I was drunk. And I was drunk in a different kind of a way. And I stayed drunk for a period of time. And this, I assure you, was the worst period of time of my life. I would drink a week, not drink a month. I would drink a month and not drink a week. I would drink and go to meetings. I would go to meetings and drink. I would drink and not go to meetings. I would not drink martinis, but I would drink scotch. Or I wouldn't drink scotch, but I'd drink martinis. And it was murder. It was murder. Many of the problems that I had not had up to my initial entry into this program, I assure you, I had during that year and a half. It was murder. It was absolute murder. But my time came. My time came. I think that there is a time for all of us. I think, Grady, that there is a point beyond which we are not permitted to go. And my time came. It came one day when I was sick and about 5 days away from a drink, and I was shaking and I was nervous and I wanted a drink. And I did something I had not done with any sincerity before. I asked someone to help me. I called a guy. This man is a longtime member of AA and is only incidentally another lawyer. His office was near mine, and I called him. His name is John. I asked John to come over and see me. And John came over to the office, and I asked him what I would have to do to be as successful as he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, "Don't drink." Well, I didn't want him to tell me that. I told him, I said, "John, you know, just save that baby talk for those morons who go to those meetings. I wanted John to give me some large philosophical concept. And we would have a debate, and I would win the debate. Or even a theological discussion. And he gave me that look. You know that look that longtime members of AA reserved for people like me? He looked, and he said, "Don't drink." He said, "Don't take the first drink." He said, "Don't take the first drink today." He said, "Don't drink now." He said, "You don't have to drink. You just want to drink. And don't drink." And I would say, "John, how about that?" And he'd say, "Don't drink." "Well, on the other hand, blah, 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 blah. Moreover, blah, blah." And he'd say, "Don't drink." And he stayed a period of time. And that's all he said. And I was getting weary and punchy. And he said, "Time for you to go home." And he took me over to Grand Central, and he put me on a train heading for Larchmont. And about halfway up, I reconsidered. And I thought to myself, "What did I call him for? He doesn't know anything. He's not a better lawyer than I am. Nobody's a better lawyer than I am. Well, I'll get into Larchmont. The station is a place right there. I'll have a couple of pops. No need to panic. Stay cool. Big success like you. Nothing to it. And I'll have a couple of pops, go over the house, get in a few quarts, and lay siege." That was my mood, and I got off the train at Larchmont, and at the platform, standing on the platform, was my mailman, the chairman of my group. Now, I don't hang out with mailmen. I don't talk to people. I don't talk to mailmen, volunteer firemen, taxi cab drivers. I don't talk to those. I deal on a very stratospheric level. And he said, "Get in the car." And I said, "Al, go away, Al." And he said, "Get in the car. Some guy from New York called me about you, and you get in my car." Well, I got in Al's car. And we took a ride, and he dropped me off at the house and said he'd be back for a meeting. And I went to a meeting that night with Al, and I didn't drink that day. And Stephanie was a great, great assistance to me. And I had a day, and I had a week, and a month, and a couple of months. And it was my habit to have lunch with John. Now, one day we were at lunch, and John looked at me, and he said, "You know, there is a great deal more to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous than simply not drinking." He said, "All you do is you hang around, you don't drink. There's much more here than that." He said, "Why don't you read the material?" And I said, "I have read it, John." And he gave me that look. And he said, "Read it again." Well, I wanted to be like John. It's really that simple. I wanted to be like that man. I wanted to be like you. And so I began another look at the material of this program. And like Louise, I believed in the material, the written material of this program. You know, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I read the book. I did read it. And I thought to myself, well, it's not a particularly well-written book. That was in my capacity as literary critic to the world. But then I reasoned, well, it doesn't have to be a great book. It isn't literature. It's not supposed to be literature. It's sort of a how-to-do-it kind of a book. I also thought that the book Alcoholics Anonymous was
written by someone who might have had some scholarly or academic type interest in the subject of alcoholism. And that whoever this shadow was who had written the book, he had written it with a vague hope that somewhere, somehow, sometime, someone, maybe, would look at this book and perhaps would have some success. I did not understand then, but I think I understand now, that the book is nothing more or less than the chronicle of the early members, the early men and women of this program, and that the steps written in that book, in its fifth chapter, which was read here tonight, is really the chronicle of their progress, and that the steps were taken by them literally as steps to their recovery. I thought when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous that if I said that my name was Ray O'Keefe and that I was an alcoholic, I had done something about the first step of this program. Of course, that's my name, and I'm an alcoholic. But our early members, these men, these women, did a great deal more than simply admit they were alcoholic. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives were unmanageable. Their lives were unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. They were powerless. They had no power. There was no way that they could control their relationship with alcohol. It says in our book that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his total incapacity for power. He has no power. He is powerless over alcohol. But they stopped drinking, and time began to pass for them, and time has passed for me. And if you come here new to this program, time will pass for you. And time has a way of passing in Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. But after a succession of days, and at no given time, but sometime, these men and women came to believe that there was a power, and that this power could restore them to sanity. And this was not just a casual observation that they made, or an offhand opinion that they shared. They believed this. This was part of them. They believed that there was such a power. And I believe that there is a power, and that this power can restore me to sanity. And so firm was their belief in this power, this God, as they each understood him, that they made a decision that they would turn over their will and their lives to the care of this power. And they were very, very bright, because the thing that was killing them and the thing that was killing me for all those years was my own will. I am what the book refers to, an extreme example of self-will run riot. And they were bright too, because at a time when no one else in this country had this notion, they conceived alcoholism to be a disease. They conceived it to be a disease that was physical, mental, and spiritual. A disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirit. And when they stopped drinking and admitted their own powerlessness, they found that their bodies responded quickly. And when they came upon and believed this power could restore them to sanity, they began a mental recovery, which was slow but noticeable. And then they came to this giving up of the will. This thing that was the difference between their being dry and their being sober. And it was in this area of the spirit where I was the most sick. There had been in my life a terrific wasting of a spirit. And there really wasn't much there. But when they allowed this step to come into my life, I began what they began, a basis, at least, for a spiritual way of life. They were also bright enough to know that it wasn't enough for them to stop drinking and to start praying. That had never worked for anyone. Would not have worked for them, I don't think. They knew that if they were to succeed in what they were doing, somehow they would have to change. And in order to effect this change in themselves, they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory. They could be searching because by now they were clear mentally. And they could be fearless because they had turned over their life to the care of this God, this higher power that they believed in. Imagine an alcoholic without fear. It embarrasses me to tell you that the ruling emotion of my life when I was drinking was fear. The great man and the boy professor was afraid most of the time. But this program has helped with that, as it helped them, as it helped our founder. When they had completed this inventory of themselves, so great was the love and the compassion of these members, one for the other, that they were able to take this inventory and go over it with another. And for the first time in their lives, and certainly for the first time in my life, they began to become honest. They actually let another human being see them as they were. I spent an awful lot of time when I was drinking making sure that everybody knew who I was. And I spent just as much time and more when I was drinking making sure that nobody knew what I was. And it was a great relief to be able to take this thing and to present it to my friend John. And then these members developed an attitude. They became willing, a willing alcoholic, almost a contradiction in terms. They became willing to have the power help them with these defects. They became ready, entirely ready, to have these defects taken from them. And they humbly asked this power that they believed in to rid them of these shortcomings. And it worked. It worked. And they were also smart enough to know that it wasn't enough for them to do this terrific job just on themselves. They knew that they had not come here alone. They knew that in their life there was a certain amount of wreckage, baggage, things they carried around with them. And so they became willing to make amends to anyone they had ever harmed. And they did that wherever they could You may remember the story of Dr. Bob's first full day of sobriety. He spent it driving around Akron, Ohio, in an old Buick. And when he got back around midnight, Bill asked him where he'd been, and he said, "I was out mending my fences." He was sober a day. He was making amends. He knew the importance. He also knew that he didn't have to wait to do it. I don't think, really, that we need wait to do things in AA. I think we ought to do them as he did them, as these early members did them. And by this time in their development, I think we had some fairly sober people. And they knew that what had been given to them was something extremely precious. And they wanted to maintain it. So in order to maintain it, they continued this inventory process. They took a personal inventory. I think they did it on a daily basis. They knew that they could not afford the luxury of a resentment. They knew that they could not indulge themselves in self-pity. They knew that if they became truly resentful, they would drink. And if they drank, they would die. I know something of resentments. I know what they can do. I have been whipped around by resentments in my lifetime. And I know that I have to let go or I will die. And so, when they were wrong, they promptly admitted that they were wrong. So great was their reliance upon this power that they believed in, that they resolved that they would effect a conscious contact with this power. And they did that by prayer and by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They listened. On the odd chance that this power that they believed in would speak to them. And that power did speak to them through the members of this program. Because every member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is an instrument of the higher power. And he brings hope, comfort to his brothers. And they prayed. Brothers, they prayed. And you and I are not too sophisticated to pray. And when they prayed only for knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry that out. And a little later in their development, they came upon a prayer they thought appropriate. So they took it, and they made it their own. And they prayed for themselves. And the only thing they asked was peace of mind. And they asked God to grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they had changed. Something had happened to them. They were different. Something had come into their lives. There was a great difference in them. There was a conversion of their values. There was a substitution of their standards. This conversion, this difference between them drunk and sober, they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had this spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were hopeless and helpless and powerless. These were the ones without power. And they found that having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, they held in their hands and in their hearts and in this program one of the greatest sources of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the ability and the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They actually had in this program the power to save a life. They held in their program great power, and they utilized as raw material the basic power of example, one alcoholic for another. And they did it quietly, and they did it anonymously, and they knew that this anonymity was the spiritual foundation of their program. And they had it. And armed with this terrific power, this fantastic thing that they had, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on top of a mountain in Tennessee. And that's a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew what my friend John knew. They knew what John knew, that there is in this program a great deal more than a simple device to stop me from drinking. They knew, as my friend John knew, and as your friend Jim Hires knew, that what had been given to us was nothing more or less than an entirely new way of living. And in order to preserve and to protect and to maintain that new way of life, they resolved that they would practice the principles of this program in all their daily affairs. And where they had been, as I had been, entirely dishonest, they at least tried to introduce into their lives a semblance of honesty. Where I had been, as I had been, terribly arrogant, they at least began to adopt into their lives a principle of humility. And this has gone on now for some period of time. And no matter what else may be said about it by speakers who come to you from all over your country, the thing about all of this which has significance for all of us is that it works. It actually works. And sobriety in AA is something more than a faith in something that cannot be seen. The sobriety in AA is something real. It's something tangible. You see sobriety. You talk to sobriety. You ride in automobiles with sobriety. You have fights with sobriety. You come to this mountain with sobriety. Jim Hawkins was right. I told him that there is in this room right now a spiritual force that you can hold. And it is almost unique to you. Will not embarrass you with a testimonial, but I will tell you that there is something very special going on in Mount Eagle Tennessee. I could stand here before you for a lot more time, and I could tell you of all of the good things that have happened to me and to my family as a result of my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I will leave that to your imagination. Whatever you can think good of the O'Keefes has most likely already happened to my family as a result of being a member of this program. If you are of a biblical turn of mind, I will leave you something I read in an AA pamphlet. The author, making reference to the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons, and John sent two of his friends to see his cousin Jesus to ask the Lord whether he was in fact the one they were waiting for, or ought they wait for someone else. And these men came to our Lord and they said to him, "Are you the one? Are you the one we are to wait for? Or should we wait for another one?" And he really didn't answer the question. He gave them a message for John. He said, "Go back to John and tell John what you have seen and what you have heard. And tell John that the lame walk and the blind see, and the dead rise, and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." When I was a boy, I learned that the word gospel meant good news. So after a period of years in this program, I would like to report to you on only what I have seen and only what I have heard. It seems to me that the blind do see, and the lame do walk, and the sick are made well. And over again, through the longest day, and into the darkest night, the alcoholic, the poor in spirit, has the good news of this program brought to him. God bless you.